Welcome to Sassy Reads for You with Annette Botko, a.k.a. Dolly's Daughter. Sassy takes you surfing through books and her own perspective on reality. A production of Cosmic Reality Radio.
Hello, and welcome to Sassy Reads for You. I am Sassy, and we are reading Cosmic Reality by Nancy L. Hopkins. There are two books in this one book, and we have started with the John Kennedy Jesus Christ connection. We are on Chapter 3, the section called Philadelphia Experiment, and this recording will be aired for the first time on September 2nd, 2020. It is produced by Nancy L. Hopkins, who also wrote the book, and she had asked me to read it, even knowing that I'm a skeptic on most things and all the different realities tend to drive me crazy. I do believe in aliens, which we've already talked about a little bit in here, and time travel, I like the thought of it, and I'm still a little skeptical about that too, but that's also in here. So we've got a few things that we've been talking about that I'm working on deciding if I believe or not. And I believe very strongly that it's up to you to do your own research and you are responsible for what you believe. Just because I'm reading this book or just because Nancy wrote it doesn't necessarily mean that it's true to you, and you need to decide for yourself what's true and what's not true. So do your research, not just on this, but on everything. Okay, so, I also wanted to say thank you very much to my mother, who helped with last week's reading because my computer was being not friendly and my recording ended up not being able to be used, and I had to work my normal day job the following day, so she recorded it for me. Thank you, Mom. I appreciate it, and I'm sure everybody who listens does too. So, we are going to start Chapter 3, section called The Philadelphia Experiment, which was a pretty good movie. I liked the movie. Okay. Vincent Collins did not have to explain what he meant by the Philadelphia Experiment. I had just bought the book, although I had not read it. The 1979 book by William L. Moore affected me, as had David Lifton's Best Evidence. I saw it and had to have it, but it was only with Collins' prompting that I read it. I had actually bought the book before noticing the publisher's blurb. Quote, an account of a search for a secret Navy wartime project that may have succeeded too well. Unquote. Again, I was encountering the U.S. Navy and secret weapons. It should be noted that at this time I still had not read Lifton's Best Evidence, and the Navy connection to Kennedy was still unknown. Moore's nonfiction account concerns the U.S. Navy's experiments in invisibility during World War II. It was a logical result of an arms race, seeing one technological feat matched by another. The simple torpedo with its explosive detonated by impact with a ship's hull was surpassed by a torpedo detonated when magnetic sensors on the torpedoes came in contact with the hull. Let me try that paragraph again. I didn't understand that. Moore's nonfiction account concerns the U.S. Navy's experiments in invisibility during World War II. It was a logical result of an arms race, seeing one technological feat matched by another. The simple torpedo with its explosive detonated by impact with a ship's hull was surpassed by a torpedo detonated when magnetic sensors on the torpedoes came in contact with the hull. Some Americans thought these weapons could be forced to detonate. if they encountered a strong enough magnetic field before that produced by the hull of the ship. They theorized by using the ship as they would a radio antenna, they could radiate a magnetic field of such power the torpedo would explode as it entered the field, before impacting the hull. They were, in effect, conceiving of an energy shield similar to the one later a reality in the unreal world of Star Trek. There is some indication the initial conception of creating a magnetic field to detonate the weapon was expanded, based upon a fact of science. While no one can explain why, whenever a magnetic field exists, there is a complementary electric field. Thus, one continually hears of the electromagnetic field. Some thought it possible that in creating a magnetic field of great power, the corresponding electromagnetic field would be strong enough to interfere with an enemy's radar. Radar, by the way, is just another byproduct of the same techniques used in radios and televisions. In all three cases, the first step is to create an electromagnetic wave radiated through an antenna. In signals used for radio and television communication, the signal is intercepted by a receiver which is able to decipher the message as voice, music, data, or visual pictures. In radar, the receiver is actually co-located with the antenna. The signal goes out, bounces off some object, and returns to the receiver, where electronic measurements are calculated on distance, size, and even speed of the object. It was thought a strong enough electromagnetic field surrounding a ship could interfere with an enemy's radar signal to a point where the radar receiver would not be able to understand or perhaps even receive a returning signal. Then someone expanded upon this theory to wonder if it was possible to also interfere with light itself, which is just another form of electromagnetic energy. If the energy field surrounding the ship were of sufficient strength, the theory went, light signals would be distorted to the point the human eye could not perceive them, in the same way the radar receiver could be made useless. All right, I gotta tell you, I almost didn't pass science. It was the only thing I was bad at. It makes me crazy. So I hope you guys are understanding this, because I don't know if I am or not. In wartime, there was no time nor facilities to take long, cautious, experimental approach to proving theories. Instead, scientists went for broke. They had to see how far they could go using one experiment. The experiment was conducted on the USS Eldridge destroyer escort DE-173 in October 1943. The Eldridge was berthed at the Philadelphia shipyard the day they attempted creating their energy field. They were using a powerful electromagnetic generator called a degausser. The air surrounding the ship grew slightly darker until it evolved into a thin cloud of green mist, accompanied by the sound of a rushing, like a powerful wind encircling the vessel in a counterclockwise direction. The USS Eldridge disappeared in the mist. Minutes passed before the ship again appeared, although the form of the ship displacing the water besides the berth remained observable throughout the entire period of the vessel's invisibility. The prevailing theory is the electromagnetic field they generated had been of such intensity light waves had actually been bent, making the ship invisible to the human eye. The prospects of such an ability must have stilled the warriors with thoughts of incredible victories. There was, however, one problem. The sailors who had been on the ship during the experiment also disappeared. Unlike the inanimate ship, the humans did not come out unscathed. More uncovered evidence, some of the sailors did not reappear with the ship. Others became mentally deranged and died. A third group were observed to become invisible after the experiment. Supposedly, these people could be brought back into the physical alignment if someone reached out and touched them, yet eventually they are all supposed to have disappeared. The Philadelphia experiment demonstrated the possible consequence incurred by individuals coming under attack by powerful electromagnetic fields. In addition to physical death and mental dysfunction, they could experience disruption of the molecular cohesion of the physical body, resulting in disappearance. Sounded awfully similar to the effects Vincent had described in relation to a psychic weapon. So I wonder if they told those soldiers that they were going to be experimented on before they did this. I'm just wondering that. It's not in the book. I'm just wondering. Or did they just say, they're soldiers. They signed up for anything we want to do to them. Not that we would ever do such a thing to our own soldiers. Just throwing it out there. Okay, that's the end of chapter 3. We are now on chapter 4. I love the title of this. Chapter 4, Your Daddy Was a Weirdo. In the last chapter, we discussed cosmic rule number 5 concerning chance being a pseudonym for thought. Most of the time, chance brought me a book providing pieces of the puzzle. Some secrets were freebies provided by a person who had access to certain information. People just tell me the strangest things, and many of these people came through my army involvement. After leaving the active army, I joined an army reserve unit. For 1 week and a month and 2 weeks during the summer, I again put on the army uniform. One of those 2 week stints took me to a training center where I met an inspector for the United States federal prison system. This government employee and I had been conversing for some time before he told me about an experience still bothering him. While inspecting a prison facility in Washington, D.C. area, a prison official showed the inspector a building on the prison site not being used for prisoners. The building was a storehouse. Inside were boxes upon boxes. When the official opened one box, the inspector was shocked to see black military uniforms. According to the official, these were to be worn by members of the Federal Police Force, a security force to be created when the U.S. president federalized all state police. My disbelief mirrored the inspector's initial reaction, but the possible existence of such a federal police force, he further explained, could already be ordered by law. He wrote down a number and sent me off in search of a law enacted in the form of a presidential executive order. Executive Order 11921. Executive Order 11921, signed by President Ford, amended a previous Executive Order 11490, signed by President Nixon in October of 1969. The amendment was issued as part of the Federal Register, Volume 41, Number 116, dated June 1976. Together, the Office of the President of the United States was given the powers of government censorship, control over the production and distribution of all materials and their production facilities, including petroleum, solid fuels, gas, electric power, water, food, farm equipment, fertilizer, and minerals, complete control over the means of transportation, the right to distribute health resources. The only thing an aspiring presidential dictator had to do upon gaining the presidency was to enact Executive Order 11921 in any national emergency type situation that might conceivably confront the nation. What that entails is not stipulated. Existence of a contingency plan to centralize basic economic, transportation, and health activities of America by an agency of the federal government was unnerving. The degree of nationalization planned would give the U.S. president powers of a dictator. Images of a dictator brought forth thoughts of Adolf Hitler and Nazi Germany, which took me back to Vincent Collins and his neo-Nazis operating psychic weapons. Nuclear Nazis. I wonder if that order meant that President Trump would have been able to call on that executive order 11921 during this whole COVID thing, like when it began, if that would be considered emergency enough. Because if he was a dictator type, I would think that would have been a good place for him to do it. But he didn't. Just saying. Okay. Nuclear Nazis. Envisioning a federalized prison force wearing black uniforms brought forth images of Nazi troops strutting through Europe and Russia. Images of Europe in the 30s brought forth realities of the 40s, when an estimated 2 million members of the Nazi Party appeared to have evaporated after the war. And with them went untold billions of dollars in pillaged treasures stolen from conquered people. I have always wondered where all the money went and where the Nazis had taken refuge. The problem was to convert pillaged funds into something respectable. Again, fate entered the picture, and I came in contact with the nuclear power industry through John G. Fuller's We Almost Lost Detroit. Fuller's nonfiction account of the Fermi nuclear reactor that went critical and has remained a nuclear graveyard put the fear of God in me. After researching the nuclear industry, I was convinced those who were perpetuating its growth were totally out of their minds. The Secret Dangers of Nuclear Factories demands a book of its own and is beyond the scope of what we are doing here. What is important is a chance encounter with a book provided an explanation of what happened to the Nazis' treasures. Billions of dollars could have been sunk into the nuclear industry while not affecting other economic sectors controlled by established power brokers. The best part was nuclear industry could never really become a competitor to oil. When your local power company goes to the price regulation people asking for a rise in the cost to the consumer, the power company is asking for its investment money back. Rate hikes are dependent upon investment money. The more the power company invests, the more they can charge. Nuclear power plants suck up an enormous amount of investment money and can never become cost-effective. To cover the expenses of one nuclear plant, you could pay off pollution-free conventional power plants many times over. In fact, the only reason nuclear power plants were allowed to be built was probably to convert dirty money and/or have an excuse to continue bilking the consumer with outrageous hike rates. And again, whether Nazi money was at the root of nuclear evil or not, the United States government was involved in yet another cover-up. Nuclear plants have gone to meltdown, and Americans have been lied to about the results. I no longer question why the Soviet Union had been so active in spying on U.S. industry and financial activities. President Eisenhower's last address to the American people carried the warning to beware of the military-industrial complex. I also heard that at the end of his life, Lyndon Johnson spoke often of a conspiracy. I wondered if this was the rambling of an old man, or whether he also knew of a financial and industrial conspiracy that could effectively control the U.S. Another book enters the picture, Howard S. Kant's The Warmongers. This nonfiction documents the interrelationship of finance and industry, as well as the manner in which they control the fields of politics and academia. It was obvious America was under control of a select and limited group of men. What was bothersome was the question of what type of men. What if Kennedy understood the dangers of such a merging of industry and finance? Reasons given for his assassination were that he was trying to bust the power of the unions. He was after the mafia. He had ordered a withdrawal from Vietnam. And just simply, he was a threat to too many people. But what if Kennedy had uncovered a conspiracy to gain complete control over the United States and perhaps the world? Could he have seen the handwriting on the wall and anticipated a day when a law such as Executive Order 11921 would exist to legalize a federal police force? My paranoia was continuing to be substantiated by my learning and experiences. Black uniforms marched through my thoughts. Vincent Collins had asked me to do a long-range telepathic intrusion on a group, resulting in my mind being filled with the very symbol of Nazi Germany, the swastika. And was the Nazi connection through Oswald's handler, George de Morenschitz, something more than an interesting antidote by a bygone past? And what was the Navy's role from George's to the autopsy? From George to the autopsy. It all boiled down to this. Could the facts concerning the planning, execution, and cover-up of the Kennedy assassination been kept secret because the main players were all neo-Nazis tied forever to some oath by loyalty? At about this time, Cosmic Reality No. 5 kicked in again, and an acquaintance of mine in the Army Reserve Unit handed me a book saying, "I think you might like this." Bohemian Groove. The full title of the book is The Bohemian Groove and Other Retreats, A Study in Ruling Class Cohesiveness. Its author, G. William Dumhoff, has a 1974 copyright on this tale of a retreat located in 2,700 acres of California redwood owned by the Bechtel Corporation. The Bechtel Corporation has a record of having employed a number of America's high level government officials, as well as being responsible for building half of the nuclear plants in the United States by the 1970s. Let me repeat this fact. The Bechtel Corporation was the world's greatest builder of nuclear power plants. Dumhoff acknowledges the power of the Council on Foreign Relations, the Committees for Economic Development, the Business Council, the National Municipal League, and other organizations for planning American policy and managing consensus for those policies. However, he claims these organizations are the government interface for those of wealth belonging to interlocking social circles and having common economic interests. Dumhoff claimed in 1974 that 1% of the population owned 25 to 30% of all privately held wealth, 60 to 70% of all corporate wealth, received 20 to 25% of the yearly income, are directors of American economic financial institutions, control academic and research foundations, and dominate the federal government. In parentheses, it says page 82, The Bohemian Groove and Other Retreats. Oh, that's telling you where she got that information from. None of this is new. By the time I read Dumhoff's work, I had compiled hundreds of references substantiating Dumhoff's view of U.S. reality. The startling aspect to Dumhoff's research was uncovering the paganistic ceremonies conducted at the Bohemian Grove by the Bohemian Club. The Bohemian Club is apparently the most powerful of identified social clubs for the power people. Once a year, the Bohemian Club holds a retreat, which has been held annually since 1880. Yeah, folks, 1880. Men wearing red flowing robes with pointed hoods, accompanied by funeral music and torchlight, partake in this strange ceremony. A muslin-wrapped wooden skeleton carried in a coffin is cremated. The skeleton represents care, a symbolic representation of the concerns important men bear daily. Care is burned in this ceremony, marking the beginning of a 2-week retreat. That's not disturbing at all. Basing his facts on a 1968 club membership list and 1970 guest list, Dumhoff claimed 1,500 men, no women allowed. Sexist buttheads. Not that I think women would really want to be a part of it, but why leave us out just because? Basing his facts on 1968 club membership lists and 1970 guest list, Dumhoff claimed 1,500 men, no women allowed, attended this ceremony. Further, he found 40 of the 50 largest industrial corporations, 20 of the top 25 commercial banks, 12 of the top life insurance companies, and 29% of Fortune magazine's top 797 corporations of 1969 were represented by at least one director or officer. That's on page 31 of that book. Dumhoff says, quote, "Cabinet officers, politicians, generals, and governmental advisors are the rule rather than the exception for lakeside talks, especially on weekends," unquote. And that's from page 15 of his book. "In spite of the ominous guest list, it was the pagan aspects of the ceremony I found most disturbing. Did these people really believe in wood nymphs and tree spirits and the wisdom of the owl?" Okay. A pause before continuing the tale. Why pause now? We're just getting into it. Okay. We're pausing and talking about something else now, I guess. I should probably note my continuing interest in active research into the question of Kennedy had become a way of fighting. Kennedy was only one subject I was pursuing in the quest for knowledge. I had always been on this quest since Vincent Collins and An Introduction to Psychic Weapons. Never mind the possible Nazi connection, the quest had become more desperate. Remember, this was decades before the internet. I can't imagine. In many ways, I felt not only the survival of my freedom was at stake, there was something more fundamental also threatened. It had something to do with the freedom of the mind, the freedom to think. Could a psychic weapon be used to control our very thoughts? If our minds are really like complicated communication centers, could the right signal jam our ability to think? That was my motivation, fear. And fear is a very powerful form of personal energy. My fear was focused on an attempt to learn everything possible. From the age of 30, my life became a mission-oriented. I would fight the enemy as I had been trained to fight, as an intelligence officer. Understanding the enemy is the weapon the intelligence officer brings to the commander. The reason I bring this up is to it provides the key to understanding the thought behind all the seemingly chance introductions to information, whether by book or by mouth, that took me this far beyond. The main question I have had all my adult life was, who killed Kennedy? followed by hundreds of whys. I have long envisioned a future where all the secrets have been uncovered. The most compelling reason for my having done anything was to learn more. In the process, I have lived alone with my books and computer, considered a hermit by those who are less than friends. You're a hermit. I'm your friend, but I'm still going to tell you, you're a hermit. Because my life was simplified down to the basics, I have been able to focus most of my effort to asking questions and being led to answers. The original draft of this book was in excess of 600 pages. Good Lord, thank you, I'm not reading that. You would have been bored. It only demonstrates my fanatical approach to learning. It indicates the amount of concentrated energy that has gone into my search. This powerful thought has manipulated my universe to provide me the answers. None of it was by chance. In my reality, the answers were going to come my way. The secrets were going to be revealed in one way or another. Let us just review for a moment by recalling certain chance events. At the university, the decision to transfer into history led me into emphasizing in Soviet studies, which was turned into a ticket to the highest echelons of the U.S. intelligence community, because Vietnam had kept the Army too busy to bother with the Soviets. In being chosen by the Army Security Agency and being assigned to the only unit responsible for the threat posed against U.S. electronic equipment, I gained a working knowledge of electromagnetic energy, which furthered an understanding of enhanced telepathic capabilities. There were all the books on Kennedy and the ominous Navy links, and then there was the Vincent Collins and his massive contribution, and I would not have met him without an offhanded remark about needing a psychiatrist who understood psychic powers. If cosmic rule number 5 is correct, then the main thought behind all these elements is my desire to know, powered by the firm conviction someday I really would know it all. I had envisioned a future where I would write a book which would lead the reader to the truth about reality. The future is now, and to continue on our quest for knowledge, we will look at cosmic rule number 6. You are not alone. Even if you're a hermit, I guess you're not alone. This is a rule that is, of course, true. None of us are alone. There are 7 billion of us on Earth. But does it mean we are not alone in the solar system and are being visited by space brothers and sisters? Or does it mean there are other forms of bioelectromagnetic energy forms we cannot see? Perhaps angels and elves and other spirits exist beside those energy forms we can see as animals, plants, humans, etc., etc., etc. Or perhaps it refers to reincarnation concepts, where our soul really comprises a family of people incarnating throughout history. The scope of Rule 6, not alone, as viewed by each one of us, is a result of experience. If you believe in angels and never see any, you may still believe. But how hard? It has something to do with experience moving, faith into believing, into knowing. Experience something and you will know, even when it runs contrary to what you have been told to believe or to have faith in. In regard to this rule, there are 2 experiences I would like to relate that have impacted upon how I view the universe. In both cases, I heard voices from unknown entities. I have no idea what specific chain of events led to my becoming suicidal in my senior years at the university. I am sure my decision to jump off the bridge was founded upon some rational thought process. Yeah, right. Anyway, the reason behind the decision has long been forgotten, but I clearly remember standing on the edge of a bridge in the dark night, looking into an even darker void of no feeling, prepared to jump. I heard this voice as if it was coming from someone standing behind me and to the left. It was a wonderful, melodious voice saying, quote, "You have many decisions in your life. This is not one of them," unquote. For all practical purposes, I did jump off a bridge that night. From that point on, I was sure I was not alone. I had heard a voice, and it did not really seem to matter where it had originated, whether from my soul, a space visitor, a guardian angel, or a spirit guide. It did not matter. What mattered was this firm conviction, knowledge. I was not alone, even when no other human being was in my space. I never looked back and have retained a sense that I have some ultimate destiny to fulfill. My life took on a new meaning and feelings of fullness. As I expanded my concept of my place in the universe, I was never alone. The second episode of a voice getting my attention and changing the direction of my life came when I was sitting in front of the computer. It was 1983, and this was the first computer I owned. It was basically an electronic typewriter. I was contemplating the Bohemian Grove and all it entailed. I suddenly had an overpowering image of a picture and the title, "Your Daddy Was a Weirdo." I realized I had seen such an article in a magazine I had bought some months before. I had been at the local record store and noticed a display of The Best of High Times, a compilation of articles carried in the Drug Culture's High Times magazine. Amazed it was still being published, I bought a copy for nostalgic reasons. When I had skimmed the magazine, I noticed the article because of its strange title, but I had not read it. Suddenly, the image of the article was accompanied by a voice that began relating details concerning Kennedy, Nazis, a Catholic Pope, and the Soviet Khrushchev. It was enough information. I had to jot down notes as it flowed into my head. A voice that had no audible source, but one that seemed to be telepathically received. I was telling me secrets. For the next 3 years, I compiled the data which supported everything related to that discarnate voice in my head. The search began with, quote, "The Best of Times," unquote, and Glenn Wood's article, quote, "Your Daddy Was a Weirdo," unquote. Wood claimed there existed a Freemason organization which had dominated American political life since the Revolutionary War, and the majority of U.S. presidents or vice presidents had been members of the Freemasons, also known as Masons. The article sent me on a full 2-year search for the full story behind Masonry, which was no easy task. The books relating to Masonry are few, and the most comprehensive Waite's, W-A-I-T-E, encyclopedia provided a massive amount of disjunctive information. Yet eventually, I had enough of an understanding to write about Masonic secrets. The most baffling and troubling aspect to Masonry, beyond its power, was its dedication to the pursuit of psychic powers. It was this connection to the pursuit of psychic powers which connect the Freemasons with the Nazis. Awesome. The Spear of Destiny. My friend who worked at the local library stopped off one day with a stack of about a dozen books, leaving the pile standing on my desk. The books had been donated, but the library did not have room for them. She thought the subject matter might interest me because they dealt, for the most part, with occult subjects. In moving the books, one from the middle jumped out and landed about 3 feet away. I picked it up, wondering why it was so energetic. Trevor Ravenscroft's The Spear of Destiny explains how Hitler was led to the Freemasons and other secret societies due to his fascination with a historical Christian artifact called the Spear of Destiny. In actuality, it was the spearhead itself to which the legend was attached. The spearhead was attached to the Jewish ceremonial spear carried by a Roman centurion by the name of Gaius Longinus. In his official duty as overseer of the crucifixion of Jesus Christ, it was Longinus who thrust the spear into the suffering Jesus to end the pain. The legend began. The Spear of Destiny was transported to France, where it became the symbol of the Merovingian kings. From the Merovingian... That's not right. Merovingians. I think it's Merovingians. I think. Let's try this paragraph again. The Spear of Destiny was transported to France, where it became the symbol of the Merovingian kings. From the Merovingians, the spear came into possession of Charlemagne and 44 other emperors of the Holy Roman Empire. The spear was eventually placed in the Hofburg treasure house in Vienna, Austria, where Adolf Hitler came under its power. In searching for the secret behind the spear's legendary powers over destiny, Hitler came into contact with certain individuals associated with a variety of secret occult mystical groups. Adolf Hitler's understanding of secret history gave birth to the Nazi Party. Nazi occultism. Adolf Hitler was searching for data concerning the Spear of Destiny when he met Ernst Pretsch, owner of a pawn shop. Pretsch was connected with the secret lodge founded by Guido von List. List's lodge was based upon a blood brotherhood and substituted the swastika for a Christian cross. It may have evolved from the Order of the New Templars, which also employed the swastika. I didn't know the Templars employed the swastika. That's what I read, isn't it? It may have evolved from the Order of the New Templars, which also employed the swastika. Alrighty then. Through von List, Hitler in 1920 met Dietrich Eckart, who had been looking for the man he believed existed, able to lead the Aryan race to glory and world conquest. Eckart was a central figure in the Thule Gesellschaft, a powerful and widespread society of occultists. I guess it's a good thing I don't know how to pronounce all this stuff, because it's spelled really weird and I've never heard of it, so I don't have anything to do with the occult. Just putting it out there. The growth of occult societies had sprung from the last two decades of the 1800s. One of the most powerful was the Golden Dawn, founded in 1887 as an offshoot of the English Rosicrucian Society. The Golden Dawn practiced ceremonial magic and claimed able to lead initiates to secret knowledge and powers. Similar societies were found in Germany, the Thule Society being one, and each had their own legends. The legend of the island of Thule is as ancient as German people. Thule was the magical center of a civilization which had left its secrets behind. The Thule Society believed beings from another place-time dimension could make available vast powers and knowledge, knowledge which would enable supermen to mutate out of the human species. The Thule Society believed they had the ability to tap the very energy which had belonged to the Great Ones of Thule. In July 1923, seven men founded the National Socialist Party. They had the original 40 members all belonged. They and the original 40 members all belonged to the Thule Society. Thus, the very core of the Nazi Party was comprised of individuals believing they were in communion with invisible powers. Known occultists Diopatrick Eckert, Alfred Rosenberg, and Karl Haushofer were the powerful minds behind Adolf Hitler. Through endeavors of Captain Ernst Röhm, R-O-E-H-M, a small group of soldiers founded the German Workers' Party. Their goal was to counter anti-military and anti-nationalist sentiments of working-class Germans. Röhm's party, with its core of military personalities, obtained financial support from rich industrialists. These capitalists wished to control a private army to counter the communist movement. Strengthened in the difficult days following World War I, the German Workers' Party merged into the National Socialists, or Nazis, Party under Hitler's leadership. The vast majority of Nazi followers did not know there was a central group of occultists, industrialists, bankers, and soldiers running the party. The real alluring aspect of Nazism is it nurtured within its members a feeling of elitism, an elitism that gave a right to rule the world. Nazis considered themselves heroes and justified in crushing anyone preventing them from fulfilling their destiny. To Hitler, that destiny entailed leading the German nation to world conquest through the power of the Spear of Destiny. History of the Spear. Hitler knew the Merovingians, the tribal spear, denoted spiritual leadership. For Charlemagne, the spear not only symbolized the blood of Jesus Christ, but also gave Charlemagne the divine right to act as a servant for a new covenant, and that the spear had been the inspiration for founding of both the French Knights Templar and the German Teutonic Knights. The French Knights Templar and German Teutonic Knights, medieval organizations much represented by the Nazis, much respected by the Nazis. I'm going to read that paragraph again. Hitler knew to the Merovingians, the tribal spear denoted spiritual leadership. For Charlemagne, the spear not only symbolized the blood of Jesus Christ, but also gave Charlemagne the divine right to act as a servant for a new covenant, and that the spear had been the inspiration for founding of both the French Knights Templar and German Teutonic Knights, medieval organizations much respected by the Nazis. According to legend, the spear gave its owner control over destiny only if there existed a legitimate right to ownership. Hitler had to become leader of Germany before claiming the spear. Hitler entered Austria 4 days after that nation had voted to become one with Germany on March 15, 1938. In secrecy, Hitler returned to the Hofburg treasure house to once again gaze upon the quest of a lifetime. The spearhead, which was all remaining of the spear. The spearhead was brought to the spiritual center of Nazism, Nuremberg, Germany. The spearhead became the central piece of the collection of articles comprising symbols of the Third Reich. Located in St. Catherine's Church, the treasures included the imperial regalia of Habsburg Empire, additionally, quote unquote, donated by Austria. The collection remained on display at the church in Nuremberg throughout the glorious, victorious days of Hitler's reign. During the first English air raid on Nuremberg, the church roof was destroyed. Hitler had the collection moved to a bank vault, where it was more secure from bombs. That move coincided with the beginning of the end for the Nazis. With military setbacks in Russia and Africa, the collection was again ordered moved. This time, the hiding place was kept secret. The setbacks continued, and Churchill, aware of Hitler's obsession with the Spear of Destiny, ordered the spearhead captured. The only clue to the new hiding place of the Nazi treasure came from an intelligence report issued by the 35th Infantry Division, United States 3rd Army, during a debriefing of two English airmen who had escaped from a German prison camp outside Nuremberg. There was mention of a, quote, hidden treasure being found in an underground tunnel, unquote. Apparently, as rumor had it, the tunnel entrance had been uncovered during bombing of the city. Supposedly, there was a massive vault inside the tunnel containing Nazi treasure. By the Battle of Nuremberg in April 1944, the men searching for the Spear of Destiny had verified the rumor concerning the tunnel and bunker holding Nazi loot. They also determined that Nuremberg Oberbürgermeister Mayor Willy Leibel had, been the man in charge of finding a new hiding place for the spear, but only Leiber's body was discovered, apparently a result of suicide. Even if he had lived to tell of the tunnel's location, the spear may not have been there. Leibel's secretary and the local SS garrison commander both claimed the collection had been moved again. This time, it was supposedly placed in watertight containers and dropped to the bottom of Lake Zell near Salzburg, Austria. It is not clear from army records whether the American soldiers prowling through the streets of Nuremberg were on official army business or something else. However, it was recorded that on April 30, 1945, at 2 p.m., the soldiers noticed a strange breach in the escarpment along Oberinschmitzgasse, below the towering medieval Nuremberg Fortress headquarters for the U.S. 7th Army. When the soldiers discovered they were at the opening of a tunnel stretching far into the distance, they went in. At the end of the tunnel, they found two immense steel doors having a combination lock. The United States had become the new claimant to the Spear of Destiny. It was at 3:30 p.m. on that same Monday. It was 200 miles away in a Berlin bunker buried beneath the devastated streets of a once mighty city. It was the suicide of Adolf Hitler by a self-inflicted gunshot wound through the mouth. One wonders if he knew he had lost the spear. Now, why would anyone wonder that? Well, Adolf Hitler was one of the most credible, quote unquote, channels of his generation. All right, the next section is called Hitler the Channel. And I don't think we have enough time to really get through it, so I think we're going to stop here. Yeah, we're going to stop here. So, we have the Spear of Destiny now. And that's kind of interesting. I don't know. I was reading it and picturing Raiders of the Lost Ark. The end of it with the Germans and the guy's face melting off. But I can be kind of funny that way. Anyway, I hope you guys are enjoying this. I hope I'm reading it all right for you. I know I stumble through a lot of these weird names and words. And I appreciate your patience. We will meet again next week, and I will have another hour's worth for you to listen to. Thank you very much. Thank you for Nancy producing this show for me and asking me to read the book. I am starting to find it interesting. I gotta admit, it was a little slow for me to get into in the beginning, but we're getting there. So everybody, I hope you have a great rest of your day, and I will chat with you later. Sassy signing off. Thanks.
You have been listening to Sassy Reads for You with Annette Bobko, a production of Cosmic Reality Radio. Radio player and archives can be found at cosmicreality.com.